Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Hope you've all had a good weekend, a good week rather, looking forward to the weekend, but of course everything overshadowed by that tragic school shooting in Connecticut this morning. We'll get to that a little bit later on, but you know, I guess the news can be a mixed bag, can't it? And the whole point to this program, my show, is to try to provide information concerning challenges to national security and community safety not being met by our elected officials, by those who think it's acceptable to ignore immigration laws that at their foundation were designed and acted to do just two things: protect innocent lives and save the jobs of American and lawful immigrant workers of every race, religion, and ethnicity. Incredibly, you would think it's common sense, but the world of politics and greed certainly very often cause people to put common sense or turn it on its ear, and that's really what we've been seeing. Even after the attacks of 9/11, even after the concerns about incursions being made by members of the Mexican drug cartels and violent transnational gangs, whether it's MS-13 that has its origins in El Salvador and Los Angeles, or the Russian mob or Asian organized crime. Crime knows no race, knows no ethnicity, knows no national boundaries, and that's why borders and immigration law enforcement are so darn important. But again, greed and the prospect for political power seem to trump common sense, decency, and oaths of office, perhaps. Those of you familiar with me know that I am a former senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And in point of fact, today, I am now retired from the INS, but trying to use the 30 years of experience that I've gained as an agent and as an inspector and examiner, adjudications officer with the old INS, to restore some sanity and truth to the whole immigration story. I've got a guest standing by. Let me bring him on meanwhile. Horace Cooper, happy Friday. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having your program.
Absolutely. I was just going to wrap up what I was saying and bring you into the conversation. Okay. For those of you not familiar with me, you can go to my website, michaelcutler.net. It's one word, michaelcutler.net. You can read more about my background and what caused me to do what I've been doing ever since the attacks of 9/11. Also, please go to talkborder.com, one word, talkborder. One word, talkborder.com. I have videos up, including a video with an amazing member of Congress, Lou Barletta. Lou, by the way, former mayor of Hazleton. He enacted immigration ordinances to combat gang violence in his small bucolic town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. I was the final witness. He was sued, I guess not surprisingly, by the ACLU when he did this, and I worked with him and his defense team. So that's how I first met Lou. He's now been appointed to the Homeland Security Committee. Couldn't imagine a better fit for him or for America. And finally, those of you familiar with me know that I am a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, C-A-P-S, and that, of course, is an acronym for Californians for Population Stabilization. They are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. I have many great friends out there. It's always a joy to visit with them. Their website is capsweb.org, and we've seen what's happened to California because of failures of both the federal government and state and local government to secure borders and enforce the immigration laws. So capsweb.org also has many of my articles. That's the short version of who I am and why I'm here. And now why don't we find out who my guest is and why he's here. Horace, why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, because you have an amazing background.
Well, I am an adjunct fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, and we try to look at a number of the pressing social issues and policy issues that emanate from Washington, evaluate those, and try to make sure that people understand what their implications are. I was a constitutional law professor for a few years at George Mason University. And prior to that, I had served in the Bush administration in two different capacities, one at the Employment Standards Administration, the largest division of the Department of Labor, and I was also chief of staff and deputy director at the Voice of America, which is part of the International Broadcasting Bureau. Prior to that, I was a senior counsel and held a number of other capacities with the House Majority Leader, Dick Armey. So I've done a few things in town. I still live here in Virginia, and I try to write and research and look at a lot of the issues that are coming up, and I've really enjoyed the relationship that I've developed over the years with the National Center, because I really get the freedom to try to spend time thinking and looking at projects and issues in a way that working with them makes possible.
Boy, you know, talk about Washington and thinking. That has to put you at odds with so many people.
Well, you know, sometimes employment can get in the way of having time to think. And I look at Washington and I think maybe that's an example of it.
You think,
huh?
Yeah. I remember one time I had a disagreement with one of my bosses, and I started my sentence by saying, but wait a moment, I thought, and this boss, who I came to become very fond of, held his hand up to my mouth and said, wait a minute, where in your job description does it say you're supposed to think?
Well, so you've identified part of the challenge that many people in Washington face. There's quite a degree of efficiency in the ability for even bad ideas to get executed, implemented, circulated, promoted in a way that in other parts of society perhaps you wouldn't see it happen as readily. What I look at, though, is it's not so much the bad ideas, it's the fact that the imposition of the bad ideas happen in an involuntary way. There are other settings. You know, some people are big fans of what goes on, comes out of Hollywood. Some people are critics of it. But you know what? If you actually don't want to support and promote, you don't have to.
That's right.
What happens in Washington, D.C., on the other hand, you pretty much don't have that option. You don't have that choice.
Which leads me to your latest article about the creepy black box. Boy, there is a title. It sounds like a horror movie, doesn't it? the crawling eye and the creeping black box. Why don't you tell everybody, not about the crawling eye, but about the creepy black box?
Right. Last year, Senate, Senator Barbara Boxer in particular, came up with what she thought was an interesting idea, and she said she was doing it on behalf of the Department of Transportation, and that was to mandate that every automobile in America, every car and truck, have a device on it that would capture information that would help, supposedly help with accident investigators to get information in an independent way that didn't rely on representations of the drivers or even witnesses thereof. We were concerned about it then. This bill was written in a way that we felt opened up the privacy access of private information to too many people. These event data recorders, or sometimes referred to as black boxes, they're in people's cars today, but they're not required to be in people's cars, and this law that she proposed would mandate that. And it simply said that any law enforcement officer acting under color of law, meaning acting in his official capacity, could access this device at any point as long as they, quote, were acting under color of law. And if anyone else wanted to have access to them, it would require a court to give approval. And it gave no guidance whatsoever under what terms that would occur. It also made it a crime for you yourself to tamper with your own device in your car to prevent it from being accessible. We felt those three things together made this an untenable circumstance, considering how much data these devices are able to collect. Well, that ultimately failed. The House of Representatives, a huge stink was raised, and a number of callers and listeners on radio shows, they wrote letters, a number of pressure points occurred, and it was killed. Well, the administration said, we like the idea, and we're going to go forward with it, and we're going to go forward with it administratively. We don't need Congress to give us approval to do this. We can do it without. Well, by doing it administratively, they managed to strip even the three fig leaf protections that were in this bad bill.
That's an interesting image, by the way.
And so now we don't need a court order. We don't need a law enforcement officer to operate under the color of law. And there is, while there is no crime against you tampering with your own device, there's also no crime if I tamper with your device.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you were saying in your article that it would even track where you've been. You know, like on an airplane, I believe it's every 30 minutes, the black box recorders recycle. So in other words, if there's a crash, they'll have 30 minutes or an hour or whatever. How far back would this keep on recording? I think now the black boxes and cars only record several seconds. So that if somebody was going 90 miles an hour and said, no, I was going 30, they'd be able to say, well, wait a moment, you were going 90 miles an hour, you didn't apply the brakes, and so forth. There's an accelerometer. Does this include a GPS also and all kinds of other stuff?
Yeah. Here's the thing. The EDR is going to have to be integrated into, and that's the way they operate right now, and this rulemaking doesn't change that. The EDR is integrated into the automobile's CPU. First point is about
Central processing unit, for those of you not familiar with computers.
Yeah. The first thing that we need to remember when we're talking about digital data collection, it doesn't matter if you reset the recorder every 1 minute, every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, every 10 hours. It doesn't matter. The underlying data is there. It degrades over time. And when I say over time, I mean 10 or 11 years. You keep recording a digital piece of information over and over and over again. People don't realize this. Just on their regular laptops or their computers, they create documents. They erase them. They start a new one. They create documents. They erase them. They put information that they have on their hard drive into the trash can. They hit, what is that term? Clear or erase. And the documents appear to delete. That's the word I'm looking for. The documents appear to disappear, but you can come back later, which is what criminal investigators do, and they can recreate almost all of those. In fact, if you really want to have your laptop cleaned and to prevent that kind of recreation, you have to hire a specialist. So let's start with nothing ever disappears. But if you're looking at the airplane context, here's a simple fact. The airplane, we're 30,000 feet in the air. Many times when you're talking about an airplane mishap, they're not living survivors around to talk about what happened. It's also true that even when there are living survivors that happen, if you're a passenger, it isn't essential and useful what information you have to give. Because that's not really, you're not a pilot, you're not a mechanic, you're not an engineer. So
you don't know what was going on in the cockpit, even if you are a pilot. You don't know if the throttles were at full tilt or they weren't, or if the guy had his flaps deployed, or if there was a malfunction.
You got it 100%. So guess what? The EDR gives us the kind of information that we couldn't get otherwise. It doesn't tell us, was the passenger having a drink at the time that the plane goes down? It doesn't tell us, was the passenger accessing an internet device? It doesn't tell us what kind of shopping interest the passenger has. It doesn't tell us how much the passenger weighed. It doesn't give us any of that information.
And this recorder will. And this
but
recorder
this
will.
Recorder will. That is exactly correct.
What happened to the Fourth Amendment?
It's thrown out the window with this. This isn't a slippery slope. That's the point here. This is a complete and direct breach of our constitutional rights. My vehicle right now, I have a BMW. If I put a cold cup in the cup holder, it detects that and tries to chill it. If I put something that's warm in it, it detects that and tries to keep it warm. The EDR is informed of this information. Now, unlike on the airplane, where that's completely irrelevant, well, the EDR doesn't draw that kind of distinction. It's just collecting data. Oh, you listen to a gospel station on your satellite radio, and that's one of your presets. The EDR captures that information. You took 6 Bluetooth calls. Here are the actual telephone numbers of those calls, and here's how long those calls took place. Oh, by the way, over a 6-month period, I can tell you who this person talks to the most. Again, this has absolutely nothing to do with accident recreation.
Well, let me make a point, because I want to move on to a couple of other things, but this is amazing. Now, here's the thing I have to bring this back to my core issue. Meanwhile, the same administration wants to provide official identity documents to people who entered in what they call an undocumented manner. Meaning, we didn't call it undocumented when I was an agent. It was entrant without inspection, meaning they snuck in under the radar.
Yeah, they broke the law to get here, and we don't know who they are, really.
And we don't know who they are. We have no kind of record of them, but they want excruciating detailed records of American citizens in their own country. You know, the CIA is not supposed to spy on Americans. You don't need the CIA. You just need a car these days, it seems.
That's exactly right. And then they tell us, this is the point, and the rule doesn't even require this. They just tell us, their press office, we only are planning to look at the last few minutes of the data recorder. We don't.
That's
plan
what they
to
plan, but
back.
What happens to the greatest of plans, right?
Yeah, well, and here's the thing. I'm looking at the event data recorder because I'm a professional, right? And
yep.
I look, it's recommended that we look for 2 minutes, but the 2 minutes doesn't really give me any information.
So you look back
a
little further.
Am I tempted to go another minute,
another 2 hour, last week?
Exactly. And as long as that information is there, people are going to want it. Now, let's shift it. Okay, it's terrible for the government to want to get this information and then for us to be required to. But what about letting Google get it? What about letting IBM get it?
Well, I have another question for you that you might not have thought of. New York City is pretty good about most law enforcement issues, not looking at speeding tickets so much as a money generator. You know, we know about these 3 sheriff's towns where they sit behind the speed limit sign. You're zipping down a highway, and I've been in towns like that, and I'm sure you've probably experienced it. You're on a highway that's a speed limit 65, and all of a sudden you see a sign that's a speed limit 30. Wham! Well, even in your BMW, which is the ultimate driving machine, if you stand on the brakes, you're probably going to hit that sign at 35 miles an hour, and these guys will have no problem pulling you over and hitting you with a $300 ticket, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, here's my question. Imagine if they don't need a radar gun anymore.
Bingo!
They just set up a roadblock and plug into your computer and say, you know what?
Exactamundo. My point is, what information exists, there will always be a reason for the government or even other parties to access that information for their own purposes. Now, you know what? What if you and I were in that vehicle in that scenario, but at the rest stop, we changed drivers and switched? But by the time
I get the ticket that you earned, quote unquote.
Exactly. Does government care? Oh, we got to collect this cash.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a quick story, and then I want to move on to this issue about amnesty. I know you're limited to the bottom of the hour. I'd love to have you on for a full hour at some point because your perspectives are so important and your experience is so in-depth. We got a water bill, and it wasn't just me because we were hearing about this from so many of my neighbors. I live in New York City. My average water bill, we have a very small house, no swimming pool, only my family and I live in this house. My average my monthly water bill is usually something on the order of $150. Not terrible.
Right.
Suddenly they put in electronic meters. We got hit with back-to-back bills. Are you ready for this?
Okay.
Put your seatbelt on.
All right.
Over $1,500.
Oh, my goodness.
And we went to complain, and they said, you have a choice. Pony up the money, or we will put a lien on your house and sell this lien to a company that will probably charge you 5 or 6 times as much, and if you default, they will seize your house.
Yeah. See, that's the kind of thing that comes about when the government thinks that we've got these great surveillance tools that are never wrong, never make mistakes, and the burden gets to just shift.
And you know
to
what's
you.
Amazing? When I tried to talk to them, they were arrogant, nasty, insulting. And I said, you know, it only happened for the two peak periods after you installed it, and then it went back to where it was before. In fact, it went a little bit lower than it used to be. It's obviously a glitch.
Yeah.
And one of the people that came out to check the meter told me he was a college kid working for Honeywell. And he said, we have a couple in their 80s. The guy lives alone with his wife. And they were showing that he was pulling 1,000 gallons or some ridiculous figure at 3 o'clock in the morning every day for like a month. And he said he and his wife were asleep at that hour. And how would you get 1,000 gallons in an hour out of a bathroom and kitchen sink and toilet?
And that therein, again.
And they were told, too bad, here's your bill, pay it, or we will take your house.
Yeah, therein lies this problem. And the Obama administration, A, this is a bad idea. But if you're going to have a bad idea, there ought to be a congressional process where you oversee and you set up some safeguards. And if the idea just simply can't be fixed, then you shouldn't go forward with it. But to do this in this half a ham-fisted way that's going to make all of us risky, that's really dangerous. And that's a conversation for us to have on another time, is why suing under the Fourth Amendment is unlikely to succeed against this case. But let's talk about a little bit dealing with immigration.
Okay, that's fine, and I appreciate that. And by the way, when you look at immigration, he did the administrative routine also on the DREAM Act.
Yes.
And what's interesting about that, you know, if you use the word alien, you will be excoriated. Oh, my God, he said the A word almost as though it's the N word. The word alien, and you're a law professor,
mm-hmm,
you know
mm-hmm.
the definition, and it's right in the Immigration Act. Alien, folks, is defined as any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. Not my definition, that's the statutory definition.
Right.
Where's the insult in that definition?
Well, that is the irony, is that we have moved to the point where discussing the facts, and however you want to discuss it, there are every country on the planet has the right and the obligation to ascertain who are its own citizens, who are its invited guests, and who are not. Now, what words we want to use may vary, but what they intend by attacking people and trying to treat the use of the word alien or illegal alien in combination as if it's the equivalent of some kind of racial epithet, their intention is to prevent us from effectively coming up with regulations, rules, and procedures for dealing with that. It is untenable to say that any person, for any reason, should just be able to enter the United States, stay for as long as they want, go wherever they want, leave whenever they wish, and there be simply no record of it. That is untenable. And yet, the way that the discussion is often held on the subject, it implies that that's the goal.
It's amazing, isn't it? And you know, what's also so daunting about this whole business, and you know, if you look at it, is that most people have no idea. They presume that the immigration laws are all about race because that happens to be, isn't it, the way that it gets portrayed, that this is about being anti-Latino somehow?
That's intentional, as I say. The goal is to minimize the ability for people to have an effective conversation. If you said the blue types, if you said, you know, you just name a category, the G card holder, doesn't matter, eventually that's going to be sanctioned conversation. I look at that and I understand. Then you simply don't want us as a nation to be able to. But who benefits from a society that collapses merely because it can't simply assess who are its citizens, who are its invited guests, and who are people that it either should monitor and track or should prevent from entering altogether?
Well,
every
here's
country
an interesting
has that
point.
Right.
you know, one of the groups I work with is Alan L. Freed Associates. It's the Speakers Bureau in Washington. We do seminars, or they do seminars for the military, the intelligence services, and so forth. And I was in front of a room filled with Air Force brass one day, and I decided to really get their attention. You know, when you're in front of an audience, you don't want to be accused of being an unlicensed anesthesiologist, so you you get the point. And this was an after-lunch presentation I was doing, and I figured that there's a little too much tryptophan in the turkey or something. So I said, why in the world do we still have a military? And then I kind of thought, like, maybe I should duck behind the podium, because everyone got real angry, which was good. It meant they were thinking and certainly listening to me. And I said, isn't it true that the primary mission of the five branches of the armed services of the United States, and you could argue the military of any country, is to keep their enemies as far from their borders as possible?
Sure.
And they all agreed. I said, well, ladies and gentlemen, you're all colonels and generals. It's a privilege to stand in front of you. And for the record, I'm a big fan of the military. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Air Force. My dad's brother was in the Army Air Corps. And that was the reason my dad could not go into the military in the Second World War, because of the Sullivan brothers. My father was the sole survivor of the family. If anything had happened to my uncle, so they would not take my dad. But
right.
I said, here's the point. How do you keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible when our borders only exist on maps? And we already have, I would argue, not millions, but tens of millions of illegal aliens in our country with no record of their being here, no way of knowing who they are, who they're affiliated with, or what their ultimate intentions are. You know, I had generals come up to me afterwards and say, Mr. Cutler, we never even thought of it in those terms, but you're completely right. I said, look, you have to see people who sneak in, they are intruders, and you have to question why they did not present themselves at America's peephole, which is how I poetically describe my job that I started out with as an inspector at a port of entry. Why did they come in surreptitiously? And you know, if God forbid you came home and found somebody sitting in your living room watching your big screen TV and sipping some soda pop, instinctively we would say to them, what are you doing here?
Exactly.
The problem is we don't know what they're doing here, and therein lies the clear and present danger to the survival of our country
and our citizens.
But
it is worse than that. We've got some do-gooders that would see you wake up in the middle of the night, you're arresting, you come down the stairs, someone's gotten the popcorn out, and they're watching TV in your house, and you're about to query them, and this do-gooder comes and says, you shouldn't be trying to interfere with them. They don't mean you any harm. This person isn't a lawbreaker so much as he just loves house. And he knew you had it on DVR, and he was just coming here to watch it. These agitators come in and justify what is unjustified behavior. You can't have a notion of country if it's okay for anyone, for any time, and any reason, to enter without your knowledge, stay as long as you want, come and go and engage in whatever they want. You can't have a country. You can't have a house. You can't have property.
Well, you know, and let me make a point. You know, knock-knock jokes are universally known around the world, because it's an accepted practice that if you want to enter someone's private home, you knock on the door first.
Yes.
But not where America is concerned anymore, it would seem.
Yeah. So one of the things that I say is that we're going to have to power past those who say we can't use certain words. We don't mean them to insult. We mean them to inform. We mean them to identify. If there is a super better word that more technically accurately reflects us, let us know. But don't tell us we can't use words until you come up with that one. And secondly, don't appease, don't encourage, and God forbid, don't actually give answers on behalf of the people who are breaking the law. I don't know what their motives are.
That's right.
We have a process for you to come in, and you get to answer those questions. You've actually forfeited the right to be presumed morally neutral by the fact that you've refused that.
That's right. And here's the final point. I think that, and, you know, I'm a registered Democrat, but I vote for individuals, never for parties. There's a Republican who I'm in awe of. His name is Lou Barletta, mayor of Hazleton. He has now become a member of the Homeland Security Committee in Congress. I am ecstatic about it. Mike McCall, who wrote that wonderful report about line in the sand talking about the dangers we're facing from Latin America and the intrusion of Iranian troops and terrorist organizations throughout Latin America, is going to be chairing the Homeland Security Committee. He's picking up the mantle from Peter King. But what is wrong with the rest of the Republican Party? There are those that are calling for a massive amnesty program, and don't they understand that it's not immigration that appeals or legalizing illegal aliens that appeals to lawful immigrants? Most of those who I've met in my travels resent anyone who can short-circuit that process. It's that they are voting for people that want big government. And so no matter how many folks you give lawful status to and give them the right to vote ultimately, that's not going to be good for the conservatives who want smaller government, because they're bringing in a bunch of people, millions if they do this, that will want the biggest government possible. Am I getting that wrong?
Okay. Here's my broad response.
Okay.
No party, Democrat or Republican, ought to design immigration policy as a way to advantage itself.
Oh, I agree with you. Don't misunderstand me.
I'm not criticizing you.
Okay.
The Republicans have appeared to learn the wrong lesson about the last election. Whatever recommendations that come forward ought to have merit on their own. They ought to be able to stand on their own, not about giving the Republicans an advantage, not about giving the Democrats an advantage. I am most angry that the Democrats, for some 25 years, have made dividing us along racial lines a effective tool for their advantage. How does it then help us if the Republicans say, okay, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, they've done it, we're going to do it too. Whatever.
Well, you know, you were talking about car recorders, and you're right, and it goes back to Jimmy Carter, really, so it's more than 25 years. But here's the point. Let's think about your car again with that recorder in it. What I think has happened is that the Republicans are looking at this car crash, and there's a lot of factors in the crash, but what they are focused on is that the car was painted fire engine red. They are ignoring the ball tires, the drunk driver, and the fact that the brakes were non-functioning.
All right. Well, I don't disagree.
What do you think
that
of the analogy?
I think you're right about that analogy. And I would add, if a group of Americans are not attracted to you for whatever set of reasons they're not attracted to you, it is illogical to think, let's bring in another group of people who are not Americans. Now American groups will like me. That's just illogical on its face.
Unfair competition, and you know, we even had that problem with Mitt Romney when he offered to put green cards on the diploma of high-tech students from foreign countries. You know,
absolutely.
We admit, do you know that we're admitting about 150,000 foreign workers every month, legally?
No, absolutely, we do not have a problem of we are not allowing enough people to come into the United States.
Certainly
not. We have a problem of we're not tracking who's coming without asking. We're not monitoring, we're not preventing, we're not deporting. That's the problem that we're having, and we're allowing lots of people who are coming to America for reasons that we would not approve of to carry out their activities freely. That is a policy issue where it doesn't matter whether you're a Republican, doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, that we ought to be looking at solutions for. Saying I didn't do so well in this last election, and therefore I'm going to simply disregard my constitutional obligations to maintain the existence of the country, I think is shameful.
Well, it's shameful.
I'm going to have to run.
All right. Listen, Horace, I want to thank you so much for joining me on my program. It's always a joy. We've got to get you back real soon. And by the way, is there a website you want to put out there?
Sure. Check out www.horacecooper.com. And the National Center for Public Policy Research is www.nationalcenter.org.
Horace Robbins, I wish you and those close to you a Merry Christmas, a happy, healthy, safe, and prosperous New Year.
Happy Hanukkah and happy Merry Christmas to you and your family, too.
Thank you so much. Be well. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Well, folks, that was Horace Cooper. I see I have a caller. Let me see who's calling in, and then we will continue on. Hello, caller. This is Mike Cutler. Who am I speaking to?
Hi, Mike. It's Carl. I've talked to you before on the Chuck Wilder Show.
Hey, Carl, how are you? Thank you so much for calling.
Oh, fine. You know, I want to talk to you about Michael Barone and what's going on in the state of Illinois, where they're going to be, looks very soon that they'll be offering a driver's license for illegal aliens. And Michael Barone was on our local talk radio.
And is he a politician? Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about him?
Michael Barone, the pundit.
Okay.
He's a Republican pundit, and he's not really an open borders advocate, but he's a consistently apologist for open borders, in that he says that open borders is never as big a problem as the opponents of open borders says it is. And he was on our local talk radio, Greg Garrison, who was a public prosecutor. He's famous. He made his name by prosecuting Mike Tyson for a local rape here in Indianapolis that put Tyson in jail for a while. But anyway, Greg Garrison had him on, and Barone is going, well, Republicans don't really need to be worried about an amnesty, because the great wave of migration from Mexico is over. He said, well, it was driven by the housing boom, $1 trillion in bad mortgages. Now, of course, you know, Clinton and Bush, you know, we were allowing people to get a mortgage with basically no ID and, you know, tax ID. And who knows who was getting the mortgages? We know that Golden West Financial, you know, gave out $50 billion alone in mortgages to, you know, often the illegal aliens. But he was saying, well, that's over. We don't have to worry about, if we did give an amnesty, that the great exodus from Mexico is over, because women in Mexico are having only replacement, never children. Now, he has been so wrong on immigration for 20 years. The famous political scientist Samuel Huntington, who died about 4 years ago, took him apart, and, you know, that, you know, we don't have to worry about, there is no such thing, you know, Michael Brown's kind of guy will say, there's no such thing as a Reconquista movement. Mexicans are going to assimilate just like Italians did. And, you know, Samuel Huntington was famous for just taking them apart before he died. But Brown was on the local media, and then I called him today, and I said, well, this guy is totally wrong. I mean, yes, $1 trillion in bad mortgages, many of them going to illegal ones, was a big inducement. But now you have the state of Illinois wanting to give driver's license to illegal aliens. You know, the Republican Party in Illinois has completely made themselves politically irrelevant by standing back and allowing the open borders movement out of Chicago. Now it's all over northern Illinois. I mean,
let me make a couple of quick.
It's in Lake County. It's everywhere.
Well, let me make a couple of quick observations. First of all, there's something known as the Real ID Act. The terrorists who attacked our country in 9/11 used multiple false driver's licenses, and driver's licenses that were legally obtained by lying about who they were, because while we don't have a national identity document, for all intents and purposes, our driver's licenses and non-motorist IDs serve that purpose. So, and this, by the way, is one of the big problems of what Obama did with the DREAM Act. And we also have to be clear about something else. The majority of illegal aliens in the United States are, in fact, from Latin America, and that's a function of geography. We share over a 2,000-mile border with Mexico, and what's unique about that border is that it's the only place on this planet where the first world and the third world collide. I don't know if you've ever been to Mexico, but I've walked across the border, I've driven into Mexico, I have flown into Mexico. When you get to Mexico, there is no doubt in your mind you've gone from a first-world country to a third-world country. And when I went to Border Patrol Academy, we flew along the border one night, and the lights from Texas were quite bright, even though it was farmland, a lot of it, ranches and so forth. And when you looked into Mexico, there was very little light. I mean, it was a very clear demarcation where that border is. But while we talk about Latin Americans, we have to also accept the fact that there are millions of illegal aliens who come from the rest of the world. This isn't about singling out Latinos, although the open borders crowd, the people I call the immigration anarchists, try to make it seem as though this is about race or about Latinos or Hispanics. What this is about is drawing one distinction, the distinction between being an American citizen and the distinction of being an alien. And every other country on the planet does that. You know, Mexico uses the term extranjero, which means foreigner or alien, to differentiate a Mexican citizen from somebody who is not a Mexican citizen. And in Mexico, if you become a naturalized citizen, you still can't hold certain jobs. You can't be the captain on a flagship, flying the Mexican flag. You can't hold political positions. There's property rights that you don't have. And if you stay out of Mexico for 5 years and one day, they will strip you of your citizenship. We don't do anything like that in the United States. So I want to make sure that everybody understands that immigration is not about race, but it is about law. And it's laws that the open borders folks, people who are profiting by money or power or both, don't like. That's the inconvenient part of it, to use Al Gore's statement about the inconvenient truth. The inconvenient truth is that we admit 1.1 million plus lawful immigrants every year. The inconvenient truth is that we admit over 150 million non-immigrant visitors every year. And the inconvenient truth is that we have a relative handful of ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, to enforce the immigration laws. And now they're not only being hobbled by a lack of resources and manpower, they're being hobbled by an administration that believes that the enforcement of the immigration laws are wrong. So, to me, this is astonishing that at a time when we are losing all of our expectations of freedom and privacy, I don't know if you heard the earlier part of my discussion with my guest Horace Cooper about the black boxes and cars, we are losing our expectations of privacy between technology and the war on terror, so-called, faster than you can shake a stick at it. But meanwhile, as we're strip-searching 85-year-old wheelchair-bound women trying to get on airplanes, we're doing nothing to figure out who has come into our country and who poses a threat, either because they're terrorists or criminals or gang members or would otherwise do harm to the United States, which is what those laws are all about.
Well, Mike, I mean, specifically in here in Indiana, we wanted people overwhelmingly in both parties wanted tough E-Verify laws, because what we're seeing were illegal aliens based out of other states coming into the state, you know, basically a metastasizing of the illegal alien population into Indiana from Illinois. Chicago alone has over a half million illegal aliens. Now, the state spending $4.5 billion on the illegal aliens social services, and they have over $1 billion in losses to the public in uninsured motorists. But now they're going to make it worse with giving them driver's license.
But here's the point. I don't know if you know this, but driving into our state all over the place. But Indiana State Senator Mike Delf, in fact, asked me to come out, and I helped him get SB 590 passed by the Indiana State Legislature, and it was enacted. But there's a limit to E-Verify. Let me tell you what the limit is. And by the way, I favor E-Verify, so let's clear that up. I think it's important. But the Achilles heel to E-Verify is that when the federal government gives employment authorization to illegal aliens, which is what the president is doing with the so-called DREAM Act, that wasn't an act, it was an executive order, a decree, if you will, from Mount Olympus, the White House, these folks, these people that are getting employment authorization, will sail right through the E-Verify process.
Absolutely. But can I say another thing?
Sure, go ahead,
Carl. Our Attorney General, Greg Zeller, now, we had legal challenges to this E-Verify legislation. I must have called our state rep and state senators, I mean, dozens and dozens of times. A lot of local people wanted this. I mean, people across political spectrum. But now, as soon as there's a legal challenge, he's a cheap labor Republican. We got a lot of cheap labor Republicans. The Republican Party in Indiana is very split between, you know, the people who live in Hamilton County, Carmel, the nanny employing class and everybody else. And, you know, Greg Zeller, he won't fight the legal challenge. So effectively, this legislation, which people worked so hard for, has essentially, he's allowed to be nullified. And now we're very vulnerable from Illinois. And remember what happened in Illinois under Governor George Ryan, who's now in prison. He was running a licensing for bribe scandal. I mean, you could go into any license branch, put down money, get a driver's license, get a commercial driver's license. And there was a case of the Mexican immigrant. He had lied about his visa and came into the country. Then he had bribed, and he was not qualified for a commercial driver's license because he couldn't speak a word of English.
Right.
He was involved in a car accident that killed a a reverend named Willis and his wife were driving a van with six children, a part that was dragging off his truck, and people were trying to communicate with him. It finally fell off as a hunk of flaming red metal. It hit the reverend's van. The reverend was actually in Wisconsin at the time. The van blew up and killed his six children. This was investigated. George Ryan, the licensed rabbi, George Ryan was a Republican. But both parties, whenever they're in power, they were just using the license branch system as a cash cow.
Yep.
And eventually Ryan went to jail. But now the insurance industry in Illinois, they have a huge problem with the illegal aliens driving illegally and causing
fire. All right, hang on.
Now the Republicans in the state want to work with the Democrats and pass
driver's
licenses.
Carl, come up for air for a second. Let me just tell you something. We're seeing this across the country. Let me put out a website again. My website, talkborder.com. I interviewed Don Rosenberg, who's out in California. His 25-year-old son, driving a motorcycle, was hit by an alien from El Salvador. The government claiming privacy concerns, which is nuts, and this goes back to the Bush administration and Mike Chertoff, decided to cover illegal aliens in the privacy laws. The Privacy Act only covers U.S. citizens and lawful immigrants. But now illegal aliens are as protected by that law as are American citizens, and in some ways more so. This illegal alien who got temporary protected status, purportedly, runs into the motorcycle being driven by Don Rosenberg's 25-year-old son, who is a law student. He hits the motorcycle, initially barely injures this kid, this young man. He's not a kid. In trying to escape, he runs over him three times and crushes him to death. The only way they were able to stop him was some other brave guy jumped out and basically told the guy, "You're going to have to drive over me. You're not going anywhere." And people pulled him out of the car, held him for the police. I believe this was in San Francisco. The guy was ultimately not charged with manslaughter, which at the very least he did. I mean, remember, he drove over him three times. He was charged with two motor vehicle misdemeanors. He did something like 3 months in jail. I don't want to misstate the case, but I believe he wound up doing 3 months in jail. I spoke with Don recently. Immigration said that, yes, while you are deportable if you're convicted of two or more misdemeanors, because, quote-unquote, only, imagine telling that to a person whose son was killed, this guy only killed one person, we're not even going to deport him. Can you picture that?
Yeah, there was a case very similar which happened to Logan Square, where I used to, very close to where I used to live in Chicago. And I know right now we have mayors in bedroom communities in Lake County, Indiana, like Schererville, Indiana. They're very concerned about how this is going to impact their community, because they already have a problem with so many people, illegal aliens, driving into Indiana without driver's license, without car insurance. They think that this is just going to be a total tsunami, and they're asking the governor, what are you going to do to help protect us?
Well, but you see, this is what starts to happen. We are on a slippery slope to anarchy, because suddenly what these politicians are doing is telling American citizens, you better have your driver's license, but if you're an illegal alien and you violate our borders and violate our laws and commit identity theft, which is the number one growing white-collar crime in America, we will take no action against the aliens, but we will go after our citizens. So, you know, if this doesn't turn everything on its ear, I don't know what does. The purpose for government, its primary purpose for existence, is to protect its citizens' well-being and safety. We could argue about all the other areas that the government gets involved with. You know, Mayor Bloomberg here in New York City is going crazy because they were serving up soft drinks that were bigger than 16 ounces. Oh, my God, people are going to get fat. Big problem. He was concerned about women not breastfeeding their children. Oh, my God, kids are going to grow up and they're not going to have whatever they get out of breast milk. But where illegal aliens are concerned, we have had people killed by illegal aliens. I wound up testifying at the murder trial of an illegal alien I had physically deported. And this goes back to the Giuliani administration. He's no hero on this issue either, for the record, by the way. And we deported this guy, Ronaldo Rayside. I believe he was a citizen of Panama. He was a drug dealer. He had a green card. He had his share of the American dream, and he blew it. He became convicted of a number of crimes involving drugs and violence. We deported him. This is back in the 80s. within a year, he came back, gets arrested not once but twice by the New York City Police Department. They never notified immigration. An illegal alien who gets deported and comes back illegally is committing a felony. If he has no criminal history, it's a 2-year felony. If he has a criminal history, it's a 20-year max felony. And, in fact, I worked with Senator D'Amato to create that law back in the early 80s. I'm very familiar with that law, and I'm proud of it. Well, they never notified immigration that they had basically a felon in their custody. The third time he gets stopped by a 24-year-old cop by the name of Robert Machete, he grabs from Machete's gun, bullets fly, and that 24-year-old cop died on a street corner in Brooklyn. He was part of the Brooklyn South Task Force. I had done a lot of work with that bunch of cops, and they were excellent to work with. His wife was pregnant with a daughter that he would never get to meet. I inadvertently met her in a supermarket where she was working her way through college a number of years ago, and when I realized who she was, it broke my heart. I spent a day on the witness stand because of a murder committed by an individual who the police should have turned over to immigration so he would not have been at large. And this is not an isolated case. And the problem that we're facing is that enough Americans aren't going out there and demanding, absolutely demanding in no uncertain terms, that for once and for all, the government does what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to protect Americans from folks who would come here and do harm to us. This is about national security. It's about justice. It's about fighting a meaningful war on crime. You know, with all the talk about salt and sugar, when was the last time you saw an ad warning especially young people about the dangers of cocaine and heroin?
Am I
getting any of this sideways? You tell me, Carl.
No. I mean, when people don't realize, when you have cheap labor and people cannot make enough money working 50 hours a week to pay their bills, they're working 60, 70 hours a week. And,
yep.
You know, we've had a case in our neighborhood. A guy, you know, they wanted to save a little bit of money getting their roof repaired. Well, they hire illegal aliens. They're out there all day long working, tweaked out on methamphetamine. They fall off the roof. They abandoned this guy here who has a broken arm, and one of the neighbors happened to help to come home. This guy could have died of heat stroke, had to take him to the hospital, but he was, you know, they gave him methamphetamine so they could work him 80 hours a week.
Let me tell you something. Do you realize that the average hourly wage for American workers is now declining? See, the way that we built America's middle class, government back in the 30s and 40s understood the importance of building a middle class. The immigration laws before the Second World War were the responsibility of the Labor Department. The idea was to not create an environment where American workers would have to compete with foreign workers for jobs, because the concern was that they would be displaced by the foreign workers, and even if they weren't displaced, wages would go down drastically. My dad was a construction worker. He was a plumber. He was a tradesman, as he liked to point out. And there was a time when we held tradesmen, journeymen, craftsmen in high esteem. And I don't think that a journeyman tradesman or a craftsman is any less significant than a banker or an accountant or a school teacher or a doctor. Everyone has an instrument to play in this society. And somehow we've gotten into this mistaken notion that if somehow you get dirt under your fingernails when you go to work in the morning, that what you're doing isn't worthy. And we're even doing it to the high-tech industries. We are bringing in more and more computer programmers, engineers, and technicians. We are destroying America's middle class so that corporations that aren't even American corporations any longer can maximize profit, and they're doing so on the backs of American workers and their families.
Well, Mike, I used to be a VP, I was a vice president of a major bank, one of the ones that haven't gone bankrupt. I was in IT, and I can tell you, I worked with people here on the H-1B visa. When their visas expired, they do not go home. The reason they do not go home is because many of them put up huge amounts of money to get an H-1B visa. They're in debt to loan sharks back in their home country. They don't go home. In Illinois, they keep working because since Chicago is a sanctuary city, the suburbs have now become the Cook County is now a sanctuary county, and it's metastasizing throughout the whole Chicagoland area. And I had people call, you know, people I used to work with. I knew their visa had gone up. They had called me because, you know, the guy says, look, if I go back to India, you know, my family put up all this money. I haven't been able to make enough money to even pay them back. These guys were in good middle class jobs. It's just in a complete downward wage spiral. I'm out of a job. I mean, the only kind of work I could find was freelance work, and it was intermittent, and I had to go do delivery jobs. And then my delivery job, about a third of the people, they were illegal aliens, and they all had Illinois driver's license. Two blocks from where I was doing a delivery job on the weekends and at night to make extra money, the FBI and Homeland Security raided a building that was owned by the son of an alderman. The alderman had his office right next door, and they busted him with thousands and thousands of passports, driver's licenses, matricular consular cards, you name it. That was right in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, off the 22nd. Street.
Let me tell you an interesting story real quickly, because we're getting a little bit short on time, and I'm glad you called, Carl. You know, I've done a bunch of congressional hearings, and in 2005, I was called by the Immigration Subcommittee, and John Hostetler, and in those days it was, I believe, Jim Sensenbrenner, who chaired the House Judiciary Committee, and both men showed amazing guts to stand up to President Bush. I mean, after all, they were all from the same political party. And they were
great.
I'm sorry?
Hostetler was great. I saw him at several town halls.
Well, he was wonderful. I worked with him on a bunch of hearings. I think I did about 7 or 8 hearings for him. I think we're up to 15 congressional hearings now. And John and his counsel, they contacted me, and they said, listen, we just appropriated enough money for the administration to hire 800 new special agents for ICE and 2,000 more Border Patrol agents. Problem is, and I thought those were low numbers given the fact that we have a war on terror going on, and this is 2005, but they said the problem is that the president or the administration cut those numbers. The 800 new ICE agents became 143. 2,000 Border Patrol agents became 210. They asked me if I'd like to testify as to try to stop me. Well, as I prepared my testimony, I noticed that a gentleman by the name of Eduardo Aguirre had just testified about the resources given to his branch of DHS. And, you know, I've come to call DHS, the Department of Homeland Surrender, the way they're doing business these days. And he was the head of Citizenship and Immigration Services, the division that determines who gets a green card, who gets to remain in the United States, who gets to be a citizen, and so forth. And I saw where his prepared testimony, he said his three priorities were as such. Number one, clear up the backlog of applications for benefits. Well, the easiest way to clear up the backlog is to rubber stamp approve them, because it only takes minutes to approve an application and hours or days to deny one, because you have to write a report and justify the denial. Then he said his number two priority was to improve customer service. And when I saw his number three priority, wait, it gets worse. His number three priority, believe it or not, was to enhance national security. And I thought I was going to lose my mind. I felt like my head was going to explode. Right, safety first. That's exactly what I said at the hearing, by the way. So I went berserk, and I said, who in the world, what kind of an imbecile, what kind of a half-brain can turn around and say that customer service trumps national security? So I checked Mr. Aguirre out. Mr. Aguirre had worked previously for the Bank of America as the president of the private international bank of the Bank of America, the first bank that accepted Mexican matricular cards. Now, let's take one more step and one more bouquet to be tossed in the direction of John Hostetler. In 2003, John Hostetler had called upon Stephen McCraw to testify before the Immigration Subcommittee that John chaired. Stephen McCraw, at the time, was the head of intelligence for the FBI. He referred to the matricular card as a threat to national security, because they could not be verified that the bearer of the document was who he or she claimed to be. And the Treasury folks immediately turned around and told the banks, you can ignore what the FBI just told you. Now, how stunning is that? So here we have Eduardo Aguirre, one of the high officials of the Bank of America, becoming the director of the agency that determines who gets to be a U.S. citizen. And not surprisingly, it was around that time, by the way, and the GAO did a report on it, that Citizenship and Immigration Services claimed to have lost, you ready for this number? 111,000 immigration files relating to aliens who had applied for benefits at USCIS and Aguirre's shop, including 30,000 aliens who got naturalized, but the adjudicators were not given the files. War on Terror.
Yeah.
I mean, does that not take your breath away?
Yeah. I'll just say one last thing, let you go.
Sure, go ahead, Carl.
Bush Republicans here in Indiana went all out to make sure Hostetler did not get a nomination for the Senate against when Evan Bayh retired. We ended up getting Dan Coats, who is a horrible guy on immigration. He had a D-minus grade from Numbers USA. Hostetler was wonderful. Of course, he was not a loyal Bushy, so, you know,
nope.
The media here in Indiana just tanked him, and Coats is just horrible. But I attended rallies for Hostetler, and we realized we couldn't get Hostetler in. I printed off articles by you, Mike, and I circulated them, and by Roy Beck and a whole number of people, and I gave them to this one woman because I was taking care of my mom, who has since passed away.
I'm sorry.
And I attended only a couple rallies, and this one woman made thousands of copies of what I gave her, and I tell you, that was the genesis of the get rid of Luger. We got Murdoch in there to bump off Luger, and at least Donnelly, I think, will be an improvement. Anything would have been an improvement over Luger. Luger was a pro-open borders nut.
Well, and you know, I got to tell you, the open borders issue makes me crazy. This isn't a liberal issue. In fact, you know, Barbara Jordan was a member of Congress. She's since passed away. She came up with what was known as the Jordan Commission report. And her position on illegal immigration was that it destroys America's working families, that it was horrible for middle class and working poor. And you know, they're now talking about how I'm having a senior moment, but the president of the Farm Workers Union, who they are now using on the other side of the argument, I wish I could recall his name.
Cesar Chavez?
Very good, thank you. Yes, Cesar Chavez. Oh, he was all about whatever. Cesar Chavez, if you go online, folks, and look him up, was absolutely adamant about controlling the borders because his concern was that American migrant workers were being beaten into the ground by having to compete with illegal aliens. There was a story that appeared in The Atlantic and several other magazines about how illegal aliens are treated in tomato farms, how these people are defecating in the fields. If you wonder why there's outbreaks of E. coli.
I think it was strawberry farms. I read the article. Yeah, I remember the article.
And if you remember, I wrote a piece about it. It was appalling. These people are made to sleep in the back of trucks. They have cold showers. They may or may not get three meals a day. They're being treated worse than slaves. And this is not about being racist to say we got to secure the borders. If you believe that the way to treat people is to make them suffer, to treat them with that kind of a lack of dignity. You know, when I testified before the Indiana State Legislature, and I happen to be Jewish, and it's easier for me to argue with a rabbi than a member of the church. You know, we try to be respectful of other people's religions even more than we're respectful of our own. At least that's how I was raised. There was a member of the church who stood up and said, "We must look out for the dignity of the undocumented." And I said, "What dignity? These folks are being treated worse than animals. I have gone into apartments where I have found 20 adult men jammed into a two-bedroom apartment that had been designed for a family of four with one bathroom. And all you find there are bare, filthy mattresses laid end-to-end, side-to-side. If there's any furniture, it's usually a beat-up old dresser where everyone's got their stuff shoved into it, where you flip on a light switch and you get what we used to call the moving wall. There were so many bugs infesting the apartment. You couldn't see the wall because the bugs were just busy scattering. It looked like the football stands with the fans doing the wave, and the stench stayed in your nostrils for weeks. And when I got done with that hearing, there was an illegal alien who was permitted to testify. He spoke broken English. And it was a wacky situation because I walked over to speak with Mike Delf outside the hearing room, and the reporters were there, and some woman ran up to me screaming obscenities at me, I kid you not, "How dare I, a New Yorker, come to Indiana to testify before the Indiana State Legislature? I need to go back to New York where I belong." And I said, "You know, there was an illegal alien who testified. Why aren't you taking issue with that?" And, of course, she had no answer, so went running out of the building like a screaming lunatic. And that illegal alien and three of his buddies ran up to me, and I'm thinking, boy, I hope they're not up for a fist fight. I'm getting too old for this nonsense. And instead he hugged me. And he told me that I was the first American he had ever heard speak about how terribly he and his friends were being treated. He said, look, Mr. Cutler, I've seen you on TV. I know who you are. I know you don't want me to be here, not because you dislike me, but because you believe in the law. And I understand that, but I can't feed my family if I go home because I miss them terribly. He said, but if you treated a dog the way I'm treated, you would go to jail. He said, thank you for letting people know the way they treat us. And he started to cry, and I had a lump in my throat, and this guy started hugging me. But, of course, the reporters never covered that, even though they were standing right next to me at the time of my conversation with this young man.
Well, the major opponent of Mike Delf's legislation, the state rep, I think his name was Mike Murphy or Mike Murray, he was a state rep literally a quarter mile from our house, right across the dividing line, Madison Avenue, which is a major street here in Indianapolis. And his district was full of illegal alien flop houses and apartment complexes. And this is literally less than a quarter mile from our house. They had the same thing where they had 8, 9, 10 guys living in a one-bedroom apartment. And they were working all sorts of construction jobs and ever. And he was running a racket. And this is a guy who was the chairman of the Marion County, which is Indianapolis. All of Marion County is Indianapolis. Chairman of the Marion County Republican Party, and was trying to take over our congressman, what's his name? He just retired after 30, 40 years. But he was a strong anti-open borders congressman. I can't remember his name.
That's
but
okay.
I mean, that's who was ahead of the. That was a major figure, right hand man of the governor, of Mitch Daniels, and Delf beat his guy back, and we had to get together in a neighborhood and get this guy out of the state legislature.
Well, I got to tell you, Carl, and I want you to know that, you know, you are an example of a citizen activist that should be a role model for all Americans. You know, it's amazing to me that so many Americans are so caught up in who's winning Dancing with the Stars, who's winning Survivor, who's going to win the Super Bowl.
Well, I love NFL football.
That's fine.
I love the Colts.
but first things first, we need to put as much emphasis on what's going on in City Hall, the state capitol, and especially Washington, as we do with all these other, what I call, diversions. Nothing less than the survival of America and the survival of America's way of life is at stake. And when you look at what's happening in the world today, we have growing groups of terrorists operating inside Latin America. We have China rising in dominance. We have America bankrupting itself so that it's quickly becoming irrelevant in the world. It's a very dangerous world. And if America wasn't there, and I'm not going to say that America always gets it right, but I'll tell you what, you look at America's track record, and I will put our track record up against any other country, and I am confident we come out on top. And so we need to understand that not only for America and Americans, but for the rest of the world, for freedom-loving people, this country has to remain strong and viable. And a country's security begins and ends at its borders, and the border doesn't only exist in Mexico. The border exists in every one of our states, because any state that has a seaport or an international airport is a border state. And to enforce those laws is not at all about xenophobia. It's about keeping out the criminals, the terrorists. And in fact, if you want to do a little bit of research, folks, go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182. I don't want to get heavy on law, but if you look at that section of law, or Section 212 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, they're comparable sections, the administrative versus the criminal sections. It talks about keeping out aliens with dangerous communicable diseases, aliens who suffer mental illness and are violent or prone to sex offenses, the child molesters and rapists. It talks about convicted felons, drug dealers, drug traffickers, drug addicts, terrorists, spies, and the list goes on. That's the point to the law. So it's not about keeping out decent people. It's about keeping out people whose presence is harmful to us. We live in a very perilous era. It's been estimated that hundreds of American cities are now infested by the Mexican drug cartels. We cannot protect our citizens if we don't go after blocking the cartels from entering the United States. And you know, I was on Neil Cavuto's program a couple of months ago. We got into a discussion about whether or not the number of illegals coming in is smaller because Mexico isn't sending as many aliens, things are better in Mexico, and so forth. And I told Neil, they're trying to figure out how many illegal aliens are present in this country by looking at arrest statistics from the Border Patrol. Is kind of like taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hand. The better indicator, as far as I'm concerned, as to whether or not the borders are secure is whether or not heroin and cocaine are flowing into the United States. Because those two rat poisons are produced outside the United States. We do not produce a single kilo of cocaine or heroin in the United States. So anybody who was using heroin or cocaine, anybody who's that dopey, literally and figuratively, is using something that was smuggled into the country. And the price of heroin and the price of cocaine is not going up. The usage is remaining constant. Well, if you look at classic economics, that means that the supply is unchanged. If the supply is unchanged, then the borders are wide open. It's just that simple. And so here we have an administration that refuses to secure the borders, and it's not just this administration. We're looking at a succession of administrations on both sides of the aisle because corporations are calling the shots. When I was an immigration agent, I was not allowed to accept so much as a cup of coffee from somebody when I was on duty. Yet you have politicians taking money with both hands, and most of them sell out. They either sell out to the corporations, they sell out to the Chamber of Commerce, they sell out to the Immigration Lawyers Associations, they sell out to the banks, they sell out to their own political party that's trying to gain power and money for itself. You know, when politicians are loyal to parties, they're not loyal to their constituents. There's a conflict of interest there. And there are a few members of Congress who, in my world, are heroic. And the guy at the very top of that list, and it's a short list, by the way, is Congressman Lou Barletta of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Lou, if you or your folks are listening, I want to congratulate you on your being appointed to the Homeland Security Committee, and I want to thank you for demonstrating the kind of leadership and, as we say in Brooklyn, the chutzpah, the guts to do what's right. This is what is so important. We need to support the politicians who stand up for us, and we need to make certain that those who don't stand up for us are made to find a different form of employment the next time there's an election, and we have to have a regular conversation with them, not just on election day or as it approaches, but throughout the year. You know, we go to restaurants, we're very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way we want it prepared. Nobody would walk into a restaurant and say, well, just throw some crap on the plate, I'll eat it. We tell them what we want and how it's supposed to be prepared, and if we don't like it, we send it back, and if that doesn't work, we leave. We need to be no less specific with our elected representatives. And what you're doing and what the other activists of Indiana are doing over at iFire, you have some truly great people over there, Cherie Calabro and all those folks, Greg Serbon, I could go on forever about all the folks that I've worked with over the years in Indiana. It's the actions of folks like you that should be the role model for all Americans across the country. So I want to thank you for everything you're doing, Carl. I want to thank you for the phone call.
I'll be able to do more now that my situation's changed a little bit. But the congressman I was thinking of was Dan Burden, and then the next, because he's retiring, and he was always pretty really good about immigration. And I just want to say one last thing. The next time I call in, I'd like to talk to you more about the whole drug immigration connection, because we have a very defeatist idea that we can't stop the flow of drugs in this country, and I think that that is, you know, we've proven in the past, we've had individual successes, but the libertarian and all the nuts think that we can't win the drug war, and I don't buy that.
It's about won't.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Hey, Carl, I thank you. I wish you and those close to you Merry Christmas, happy, healthy, safe, and prosperous New Year.
Yeah, and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And happy Hanukkah to all of my Jewish friends out there. Merry Christmas to everyone else, and Happy New Year to everybody. I'll be back next week at the same time. And, you know, again, folks, I want to remind all of you to always remember my famous motto or infamous motto, democracy is not a spectator sport. Please get involved, folks. This isn't just a hobby. This is about the future of our country. It's about the future of our children, and God willing, their children as well. Have a wonderful evening, everybody. A great weekend. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.